Good morning, everyone.
We would like to call the August 1st, 2019 Board of Pharmacy meeting to order this morning. I am Tamara McCants, and I am serving as the chair of the Board of Pharmacy. If we can have the board members to introduce themselves.
James Appleby, board member.
Shakita Sanders, board member.
Benjamin Miles, board member.
Ashley Bowe, board member.
Staff.
Shauna White, executive director.
Corinne Barron, health licensing specialist.
Brandon Capiz, legal intern.
Carla Williams, board counsel.
Okay, and at this time, we will ask the members of the public to please introduce yourself and your affiliation.
Good morning, Anthea Francis, College of Pharmacy, Office of Continuing Professional Education.
Don Zawada, just DC Public.
Daphne Bernard, a pharmacist.
Alumni, board alumni.
Beverly Mims, pharmacist.
Board alumni.
Good morning, Ms. Lee Depp, Express Scripts.
Good morning, Tiffany Taylor, Howard University and Walgreens.
Good morning, Esther Vidiaco, pharmacy student at Marshall University and currently on vacation at Kaiser Foundation.
Jay Kim, student pharmacist at University of Maryland, Baltimore. I'm also on the rotation.
Jonathan Trent, also a student on the rotation with Kaiser from the University of Baltimore.
Kevin Pagging, also from Maryland, and I'm a student from Kaiser.
My name is Dan
Kirk
from Kaiser.
Hi, Miranda Wall, clinical professor at Harvard University.
Good morning, my name is Scarlett Zapata. I'm a four-year doctor of pharmacy.
Hey, welcome everyone. So before we get started with the official agenda, I'm going to turn it over to Shauna White for a very special presentation.
All right, I'm not going to use the mic. I'm going to walk around the room. But first, I would like to ask Dr. Bernard to come up here. This is a special moment. We would like to honor Dr. Bernard for her years of service to the District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy. So we have a few parting gifts for her. So the first one is from the mayor's office, and I'm going to read the certificate of appreciation from Mayor Bowser. In appreciation to Dr. Daphne Bernard, August 1st, 2019. As Mayor of Washington, D.C., it is my pleasure to extend appreciation to Dr. Daphne Bernard for serving 17 years on the District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy. During your tenure, you served as chair of the board and played a vital role in passing the regulations to facilitate the licensing of pharmacy technicians, collaborative practice legislation, and women's access to care legislation. You also served as District 2 Chairperson on the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy, NABP, and on the Task Force for Pharmacists Interactive Communication Skills, and on the Multi-State Pharmacy Jurisprudence Examination Committee as an item writer. Your dedication, commitment, and contributions assisted the board in fulfilling its mission to help enhance the quality of life of others. On behalf of the 702,000 residents of the District of Columbia, you have my best wishes for continued success. Mayor Bowser.
Thank you.
I'm not finished. 17 years, we have a few more.
Can you smile for the cameras together? We want to get this appropriately documented.
So we also have another certificate of appreciation, and this is from DC Health, and it says District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy Certificate of Appreciation awarded to Daphne B. Bernard, PharmD, RPH, in appreciation of your term of service as member 2002-2013. And chairperson 2013 to 2019 of the District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy, August 1st, 2019. It is signed by Dr. Lewis, and it is signed by me,
So please give them a hand.
And on behalf of the board members, your colleague, and Herla, our Herla family, all of us wanted to present you with this plaque just so you remember your years of service on the Board of Pharmacy. And it just says, DC Health, District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy Recognition Award presented to Daphne B. Bernard, PharmD, RPH, in appreciation for your term and service as Board Chairperson, District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy, 2013 and 2019, and Board Member of the District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy, 2002 to 2019.
Wow! I thought this was going to happen at the end.
No, this is going to happen at the beginning. We definitely wanted to thank you so much for your years of service to the board, the practice, pharmacists, the residents. It's a bittersweet moment. We've grown to know each other well. So we want to thank you. I didn't know if any of the board members wanted to say anything.
No, they don't want to say anything. I'm just kidding. I will be very, very brief. I want to first start off by saying thank you to the leadership of Department of Health, especially Executive Director Shauna White. But I have to let people in the room know, because especially we have a lot of students, I owe a lot to others who kind of helped me along the way. And one of the people is right in the audience. Mm-hmm. Dr. Mims, you have to stand up. Beverly Mims served as the chair of the board while I was a board member and taught me everything that I know. There were plenty of times when I would sit in that chair right there and I would say, pretend you're Dr. Mims. Put on your Dr. Mims face. And so I owe so much to you. I'm glad that you're here. I just really want to acknowledge your service. And just briefly to say, this really is an honor to serve as a board member. Not everyone gets an opportunity to sit at this table and make some of these tough decisions that we hope will kind of advance the profession, but at the same time advocate for our colleagues and oversee the practice in a responsible manner. So it's an honor. Yes, it's all voluntary. No, we don't get paid. Yes, we do miss work and other things. So when you see people stepping out to take calls, they absolutely have to kind of juggle. But I think about everything that I got out of being a member, and you get a lot out of it. So I just want to leave my wonderful colleagues with that in mind. Yes, it is a volunteer thing, but you're going to get a lot out of having this opportunity. So make the most of it. Appreciate it. I've been on the board 17 years. You know, my oldest, I thought I was pregnant with him when I was on the board, but he just finished his first year of college, and I was on the board a long time. So I laugh when that was on the proclamation, because I'm like, if they realize I've been on the board that long, it might be a problem. But anyway, thank you. I'm happy. I'm excited, quite frankly, because it's time. I'm really pleased with the progress, but I don't want anyone to think that we have, you know, risen to the occasion the way we need to. And so I think the board is in great hands. All of you are committed. You take this responsibility seriously. You're under great leadership with the executive director and Dr. McCants as the director. And I'm excited to see where you take things. So thank you once again. And I'm going to take my seat.
not yet, Daphne. No. You're not getting off that easy. On behalf of the board, because I believe I'm now the longest tenured board member after you, just want to say a big thank you. The way that you led the board through a lot of challenging discussions and the always sort of eventful activities that happen, shall we say, from the outside environment. For example, new legislation that comes along, unanticipated barriers that had to be either navigated around or over or whatever. You were always sort of positive, upbeat. You were always saying, yeah, we can do this. We can figure this out. And that's a really important trait for a board chair. And I know that Tamara is going to be able to carry that forward as well. I suspect you learned a lot of that, as you said, from watching Dr. Mims do that so effectively. A lot of surprises come along. Things you didn't think, oh, I didn't sign up for that when I signed up to be board chair, right? So congratulations to you for your wonderful efforts in leading the board. And let me also say I appreciate how you always are thinking about the next generation. I don't know if you've noticed in the audience when interns are presenting or when issues are coming up and there are students in the audience, Daphne's always been good about saying, now, next generation, you need to be thinking about this and that, because this is what it means to be a pharmacist, and these are the hard decisions we have to make as pharmacists, and this is the patient care focus we have to have if we're going to be a good pharmacist. And you're always thinking about that next generation. So congratulations on your stepping into the alumni group. You've got good company with Dr. Mims. And thank you for all you've done for the Board of Pharmacists.
Thank you. If I may take a few moments of privilege to really just really thank you, Dr. Bernard, for your service, and thank you for serving as my mentor. And I know that I have some really huge shoes to fill, and so I just thank you for being such a positive example of what it is to be an active practitioner and to lead this board to protect the public. And I cannot acknowledge Dr. Bernard without also acknowledging Dr. Mims, because she was also the first board chair that I interacted with when I was appointed to the board in 2006. And so I am very excited about the opportunity, but I am nervous because I know I have some really huge shoes to fill. So thank you very much for your service and for all you have done to personally develop me and to make me feel like I'm ready to take this position.
Yeah, we're going to do fine. We're going to be fine.
Do I need the mic or can you guys hear me? Okay, great. So I also wanted to take this time to acknowledge Dr. McCants is the new chair of the District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy. Dr. McCants has been on the board since 2006. We look forward to working with her under her leadership, and we are excited. With that being said, we also have a new board member, Dr. Ashley Bowe. And I wanted to give Dr. Bowe the opportunity to say a few things about herself and introduce herself to the board and to the public.
Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. My name is Ashley Bowe. I am originally from Mississippi. I moved to the district 3.5 years ago. I attended the University of Mississippi School of Pharmacy. I've been a practicing retail pharmacist for 6 years now. So I'm really looking forward to my new role here and just learning a lot from everyone. So thank you.
Okay, so we're going to get started. So if I can get a motion for approval of the open session meeting minutes.
I'll move approval of the June 6th open session meeting minutes as presented.
There a second?
Second.
Okay, the motion has been moved and properly seconded. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, we're going to move forward. Next, we're going to have the there is no consent agenda, so we're going to move on to the executive director report.
Good morning, everyone. They got us these fancy microphones, but I still like to stand. I want to give some updates this morning, so I will start with our statistics report. Currently, right now, in the District of Columbia, we have 2,045 pharmacists. Of those pharmacists, 636 have vaccination and immunization authority. We have 698 pharmacy interns. We have 879 pharmacy technicians. We have 134 pharmacy technician trainees. We have 11 pharmacy technician training programs. And we have 839 pharmaceutical detailers. Also wanted to thank pharmacists and the pharmacy community for registering for the prescription drug monitoring program. We have definitely been on an aggressive campaign to send out email blasts, mailings to home addresses. So thank you to those pharmacists that have registered for the prescription drug monitoring program. We have 1,946 pharmacists who have registered. So that's probably about 100 pharmacists that we need to kind of find to have them register for the program. So thank you for your support. And please log into the prescription drug monitoring program if you need to use it in your practice. There's a lot of great information in there that definitely we think will be beneficial to you as you serve your patients. Just to give a quick update on the opioid strategic plan, it's still on the website. There was a big meeting a few weeks ago where we had some data presentation. The opioid strategic groups are moving, so if you want more information is on the LiveLong DC website. For the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy, our next meeting for District 2 is in Burlington, Vermont, and that meeting is September 19th, 20th, and 21st. Dr. McCants will be there. I will be there. I didn't know if any additional board members were interested in the meeting.
Any of the board members? No.
It's okay. We have more meetings to go around. But that meeting will be there, so we'll be representing the District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy at that meeting. The next... sit down for the next few things. The next... The next thing... Okay, I think I got it. Yeah, thank you. The next thing I wanted to talk about is recommendations for... the public health priority topics, but I'm going to wait until after Brandon gives his presentation so we can talk about suggestions.
No, because based on that, we'll decide how we do it.
Okay. All right. So I know there was a lot of discussion at the last meeting about the public health priority topics for continuing education. Just to give a recap, the director has... mandated that all of the health professional boards choose CEs from a public health priority topic. The board had some comments last time that they would like to have some suggestions on some topics. So this is your opportunity to provide suggestions, and your suggestions, I will definitely take that.
Can you remind us what the broad topics are that have been put forward by the Department of Health?
Right. The broad topics that have been put forward by the Department of Health as suggestions were HIV, medication errors, ethics. We don't have a list, but these are just suggestions that came up in a meeting. So what I'm really looking for is for the board to provide some suggestions on topics that they think would be appropriate for pharmacists and all healthcare professionals.
We're definitely open to hearing some suggestions from the public as well, but this list, whatever the topics that we suggest is going to be added onto a list for all of the health professionals, correct? So we will want to at least make sure that the topics that's important to pharmacy are represented.
Can we say maybe medication safety?
Okay.
law. Let's just throw out five.
But my recollection was when it was presented, there were a group of a bunch of different topics that were put forward by the director. Is that not the case?
No, that's not the case. We don't have a final list yet. There were just some suggestions.
I know not a final list, but they put together it's a pretty extensive list, as I recall.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes. Give me one moment, because I'm going to have to find that list, so we might have to come back soon. But that list was not final, and definitely was suggested. So give me one moment, and I can pull that up.
And like, just a reminder based on what we talked about during the last meeting, is this 10% going to be in addition to our HIV/AIDS and 2 hours of HIV/AIDS requirement and the medication dispensing error requirement? Do we want to keep those requirements? Because that was something that we talked about. I'm not sure if we came to a conclusion about.
I think that we had kind of settled on keeping the medication errors and dropping HIV as it will likely be on this list, mm-hmm. Although I still feel like that's a lot of prescribing of which C's that we should do. It would be 6 hours total that we would have to do.
Okay, so
based on what is written right now, we will have, if we went with the suggestion of dropping the HIV and AIDS, it would be mandatory for pharmacists to renew with 2 hours of medication dispensing, 2 hours of the continuing education on cultural competency or specialized clinical training focusing on patients or clients who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, gender nonconforming, queer, or question their sexual orientation or gender identity and expression, LGBTQ in other words. And then, in addition to that, that at least 10% of the total required continuing education will be of the public health priorities. And so 10% for us will be 4 hours. So that's a total of 8 hours that we will already have prescribed in terms of what continuing education sessions you will have to do.
So do we have then, maybe Carla can give us some guidance, are we able then to just by policy announce that these public health topics can replace those other ones that are already in regulation? We can just, or does that require a change in our regulations?
We are changing the regulations.
So this is our opportunity if we want to enable individuals to choose from these public health priorities completely, we could actually take out those other individual mandates if we choose, so choose. Is that right?
Well, we can't take out LGBTQ because that's a mandate across all boards of pharmacy, but we can technically take out medication and dispensing if we want to, but I thought that we said that we didn't want to, correct? Well, we can make a decision now since we're having a discussion.
I'm just trying to understand what the rules are. We have to work with that.
So we have the opportunity to remove HIV and dispensing errors, mm-hmm. and go and basically convert those to the director's list of drugs, or keep dispensing errors, drop HIV.
Okay,
that's sort of what's on the table.
So let's just come to a general consensus. So do we think that, and do we need a motion for this, or how are we going to do this?
Well, we're going to go through the regulations, and then we can do a motion at that time if I want to fix. We may just go ahead and segue into that. That's the next thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let's... Sorry, Brandon.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's no problem.
Yeah, so let me just kind of put this back in perspective. So what we discussed in the last open session meeting is that the director of the Department of Health has asked for all the boards to add to your regulations a requirement that your health professionals will complete at least 10% of your total CEs in public health priorities and list to be determined. So for the board, we also were asked to go ahead and start working on the regulations now to implement that requirement with the list still to be determined,
And then once that has been determined, we will issue through the DC Public Register, our website, email blast to let everyone know in a timely manner, so you have time to do it, what the public health priorities are. So at the last meeting, the discussion was to kind of decide, do you want to increase your total number of CEs? Are there things that are currently mandated that you no longer want to mandate because they may possibly be on that list? Even though you're making suggestions right now for what's to be on the list, that does not mean it will be on the list. So the board decided at that time what you wanted to do. So I'm going to turn it over to Brandon, my legal intern, and he prepared draft regulations based on what was discussed at the June meeting. Today we can decide whether to make any changes to that and what you want the final draft to look like. So Brandon, I will give it to you.
Sure. So I think the summary of the changes that were proposed last time is fairly accurate. You all had
Brandon. Just I know that people are looking around in their papers. So just for your reference, we are on section open session. Section 03?
Yes.
And B. So it's the notice of proposed rulemaking for Chapter 65 pharmacists, the continuing education requirements.
Other than the dates,
or
anything else?
No, the dates should be
gone. Is there anyone who doesn't have a copy?
It's been there. So it's skipped.
Okay.
We skipped
yes.
Pharmacy normal. So
yeah. Is there anyone who doesn't have a copy? Do you have extras?
All right, yeah. So if we're, what is this? Sorry. No, the mic's just not on. Sorry. Okay, perfect. Yes, so we are currently looking at the notice of proposed rulemaking for pharmacists. And so if we're looking at subsection 6513.4, that implements these revisions for applicants for renewal. And so the amendments discussed during the June open session meeting were the elimination of the HIV training requirement beginning with the renewal period ending February 28th, 2023, and then implementing with the renewal period ending February 28th, 2023, the public health requirement. So those were the two fundamental changes that were made, and those would apply to applicants for renewal, reinstatement, and reactivation. So we can make whatever amendments the board thinks is in the best interest of public health, safety, and welfare, whether that's also eliminating the medication dispensing errors. Whatever the board wants, we can implement.
So just for clarification, this will start with the renewal period start ending February 28, 2023. So for the next renewal period, which is February 28, 2021, these requirements will still be in place, which is the HIV requirement and the medication dispensing errors training in addition to the LGBTQ requirement. So what we are discussing is for the renewal period ending February 2023.
And that date is also subject to change if the board would like to.
Okay. All right, so board members, let's first try to discuss if we are willing to eliminate any of the current requirements that we have.
I think there's some additional changes. It's clearer on this new draft that the HIV would end after 2021. I think that previous draft this is clear.
Dr. McKenzie, I have a question.
Are
medication dispensing errors covered, to your knowledge, any other CE that's mandated or that pharmacists have to take each year?
These are the regulations that would delineate what
regs are mandated. So if it's not covered here, it wouldn't be anywhere else.
Okay, thank you for that.
First, are we in agreement that the it should start with the 2023 renewal period?
Yes.
Make sure that we are in agreement with that part. Okay.
And that's the period that ends. So it begins 2021 and ends 2023.
That's right. I think based on our discussion in June, we are of general consensus that we do want to eliminate the HIV/AIDS requirement. Correct? Right.
Yeah, on the draft that's shown here, perhaps 6513.4A1, it says 2 hours of HIV would be required for the period ending 2023.
Until.
Shouldn't that be until 2021?
So the current language says until the renewal period ending February 20th, 2023, which means that it's through the period beginning 2021.
Right. So it's really, because you currently have the one ending 2021, right?
Yes.
Right. So it's 2021 and 2023. So according to the document, this wouldn't start until the renewal period starting March 1st, 2023, which is actually the 2025 renewal period.
Right.
So we're actually pushing it out 5 years. Is that in line with what the other boards are doing?
Because the list hasn't yet been finalized, they are kicking it out a little further, because otherwise your next renewal, these requirements would be required, which means people should be starting to work on them now, and we don't have the list yet. So in fairness to the licensees, most boards are trying to put it out a little further if you can, kind of just depending on where your renewals fall.
So it will be two renewal periods for us. So it would be this renewal period that ends 2021 and then the one afterwards that ends 2023.
But the way that this reads in the renewal in the period from March 2021 to 2023, we would have to do the HIV plus the 10% list, which I thought our intention was to remove HIV in favor of the director's list. So then shouldn't this read that the 2 hours in HIV training until the renewal period ending February 28th, 2021?
Yeah. So I think we will restructure this. We did this for the Board of Dentistry. It just became longer because we had these are the requirements for this renewal period and these are the requirements starting this renewal period. I think that structure was clearer.
Yeah.
So we'll do it that way. So we will reformat this. I think today we just want to make sure we're crystal clear on what you'd like. So for the next renewal period, which will be 2021, I guess, you still want HIV? Or no?
Yes.
Okay. And then at that time, would we want people to start with the public health priorities? Although that means really starting now, people would be wanting to think about them and we're still composing that list. Or would we want that to start the renewal period 2023?
The renewal?
The public health priorities.
I think that, what would you ask the board members?
I think as far as fairness, maybe having it later for 2023, if they don't already know that. Like if we're still in discussions about what's going to be required, I don't think it's fair to place a mandate on what has to be done and we're not done with our part.
Okay. All right. So do we anticipate that the list will be available
March 2021? Yes, I think the department should have decided.
So I think the department should have decided a list before that time. Hopefully, by the end of sometime this fall, a list should be finalized. I apologize because I cannot pull up this draft list at this time, but I will keep looking for it to see if I have it.
Since we are in agreement by general consensus that we will eliminate the HIV/AIDS training, what are your thoughts about the medication dispensing errors training? We had discussion about it in June. just want to finalize it that we are still in agreement that we should keep that as pharmacists,
okay,
regardless on what's on the public health list.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, then at that point, I think if you just vote to amend the draft regulations as agreed to here today, then we'll make those changes and this will move forward. It will start moving forward.
Anybody want to make a motion?
I'll make a motion that we approve the regulations as draft regulations as amended here.
I'll second.
Thank you.
Any discussion? Okay, hearing none, we're going to take the vote. All those in favor, state by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The motion carries. So we're going to go back to the beginning of the, well, okay.
So we have technicians and detailers we need to discuss as well.
Yes. So there's a similar public health priority obligation imposed on both pharmacy technicians and pharmaceutical detailers. Those are also visible in notices of proposed rulemakings. Pharmacy technicians is Chapter 99, and pharmaceutical detailers is Chapter 83. Again, this would affect applicants for renewal, reinstatement, and reactivation. And so the main question I have for the board, again, concerns the timeline of when you'd like to implement this requirement. Currently, for pharmacy technicians, the public health priority requirement is written to begin with the renewal period ending February 28th, 2023. So that means during the March 1st, 2021 to February 20th, 2023 window, that requirement would be imposed. Is that still the wish of the board, or would you like to amend that starting date?
Do
I
amend the
but for technicians we require pharmacy law, so there's already a differentiation for technicians between what they are required to do and what pharmacists are required to do, right?
It's just that they would have the additional requirement of the public health topics.
And to that end, and it relates to the pharmacist discussion as well, can the same CE fill multiple requirements?
Yes.
We could read a two-hour course on medication safety. That's on the list of public health priorities would vote to fill a CE mandate as well as the public health mandate. And the total number is not going to go over 40 pharmacists. It won't go over 20 for technicians.
Right. Okay. So, after reviewing that, we'll have a motion.
We're just moving to keep the date. Is that or to accept the regulations as presented?
Brandon, yes. What are you asking?
I'm asking for confirmation on the date. So confirming that you'd like this requirement to begin with the renewal period ending February 20th, 2023, as drafted.
Is that the same as for pharmacists?
Yes.
Okay, so I'll move that we... so moved.
Is there a second?
I will second again.
Thanks.
Yeah, properly moved and seconded. Any discussion? Okay, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The motion carries. And lastly, detailers.
Yes. So the date requirement does differ for detailers because of the renewals occurring in even years rather than odd years. So currently the draft notice of proposed rulemaking states that the public health priorities will begin with the renewal period ending February 28th, 2022. So that would mean beginning March 1st, 2020, that requirement would be imposed on pharmaceutical detailers. I know there is some concern about that timing in light of the fact that there's no set date that the department will release the topics by. So if there's an interest in pushing that back, that's possible. Otherwise, we can leave it as it's currently drafted.
Just to clarify, if we did push it back, that would be to February 28, 2024. So, board members, what is your pleasure?
Just to be clear, I'm sorry, I was writing. our options are for their renewal period ending in 2024 versus 2022.
Yeah.
Okay. Then I move that we say that it starts with the renewal period ending in 2022.
Is there a second?
No second.
Thanks.
Any discussion? Hearing none, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor indicate by stating aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion carries. Well, thank you. Then we'll move all these forward and let you know if any changes come up along the way.
Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you, Brandon. Thank you, Father Brandon. So moving back to the Executive Director's Report. Okay, thanks for bearing with us as we learn how to use our new technology here. I just wanted to comment on the pharmacist CE audit that seems like it's never ending, and I wanted to give an update to the board and to the public of the CE audit. So this is the CE audit from the 2015-2017 renewal. We audited 293 pharmacists during the audit. Of those 293 pharmacists, 202 of those pharmacists passed the audit. We have 83 individuals that failed, and we have six individuals that are pending. I would like to say a NOI or notice of intent to take disciplinary action because they did not respond, and we have two individuals that are pending board review. So I did want to let the board know that we should definitely, the labor intensive, just because of the amount of number of individuals that we did audit, and just if they had any suggestions on the audit process or anything that they think that would be able to assist staff in doing the audits in a more timely manner.
What percentage of people audited had an issue?
Right. So that would be, I didn't do the percentages. We just have 83%. So that would be close to a little less than a third. Yeah.
One out of three individuals failed to complete their CE.
Yeah. So, and this was a 20, this was a 2015
this was a 2015 audit, not the last audit. On the last renewal, we did ask pharmacists to submit their CEs in the new licensing system. So we did have that option to upload versus we didn't have that option to upload during the 2017 renewal period.
Generally speaking, why were people failing the audit?
Could you all hear Dr. McCain?
Can you guys hear him? Okay. Yeah.
So she asked, generally speaking, why were people filling all that? They were missing CE requirements. So they were missing live hours. We had a good number of individuals. I can give a more detailed report at the next meeting. But they were missing hours of live, missing HIV, and med errors.
And this is only going to be complicated further by our new requirement.
Yes, as Dr. Miles stated, this is only going to be complicated more for the new requirement. So I just wanted to hear the board's suggestions or any feedback.
One thing that I would suggest is that maybe we require that people submit the NABP monitor, the summary statement, because last time we received a lot of individual sheets of paper that you had to manually go through. So that would raise things a little bit.
So Dr. Miles suggested that make it mandatory that individuals submit the NABP CPE monitor transfer. So most pharmacists are registered with NABP. We asked for this number during the renewal period, the CPE monitor number, so we know they can access their transfer.
Two questions. Currently, when we do the audit, is there a deadline date for the pharmacists to submit their paperwork to be audited?
Yes, and that is always complicated because we mail things out and then we're waiting for us to receive mail.
So for the 293 people, did they all receive the notice at the same time?
Generally, yeah. Everything pretty much goes out around the same time.
Okay, and what is the deadline date for them to send the stuff back?
Right. We usually, so I can explain the process. Right, so the audit letters do go out, and we try to send them out at batches. From our vantage point here, they typically go out all at the same time. So we send one mailing notice out, the first notice, and we send that out regular mail, and the second notice we send it out certified mail. So in the notice we do give individuals
30 days.
We do give them 30 days to respond.
So in terms of a suggestion
for us to be
a little bit more efficient when we are looking at these renewals is to first ensure that, I think that the language in the letter needs to be a little bit stronger in terms of when people have to submit their documents by, and if they don't submit their documents by that time, then they should be automatically fined. I feel like we go back and forth in terms of determining, you know, waiting for people to send the stuff back to us, and oh, they didn't get the letter, or whatever the case may be, and then it stretches out for a year or so. So is there anything that we can do that we send them the initial letter, they get the deadline, and then once they get the certified letter, if they don't get send it back by a specific time, that they automatically get fined? Is that something that we can do?
Yeah, I don't know if I need it, but
we can actually address that in one of two ways. We can either put something in the regulations that says you shall respond within 30 days, and then if you don't, it's a violation of the regulations. The other thing we can do is, instead of it being a letter, it can be drafted as an order from the board. You are ordered to submit your CEs within 30 days, and then if they don't, then it's a violation of a board order.
So is that something that we have to vote on, or?
Yes.
Okay. Are we, is this something that you want us to resolve today, or are we just brainstorming?
It's up to the board if they want to resolve it today, or if they want to discuss
the issue that we're trying to address is the fact that it's taken 2 years and we're going into the next renewal season to complete the audits. So that's not the only, there's several factors that may relate it to that. It's the respondent, you know, the time that people are taking to respond to the audit, and then the second factor is also our participation and actually, you know, buckling down and taking the time to really just review all of the audits. So the first question is, are we okay with the length of time that it's taking right now for us to complete an audit? Okay. What was your question?
So I have a question. Can we possibly have input from those that work the audit so we can understand what they go through and what ways that we can improve? Like, I think one thing is great for us not to have to do snail mail when we get things, especially if it's a cost savings mm-hmm. to the board or to the, health department? That would be great. And then also, if we can have, like, maybe an additional meeting, that we can just come in and just tackle them all in one day to have it done, to possibly help out with some administrative heavy lifting that the staff members have to go through. So, but maybe we can just hear their perspectives and have more of an understanding of how we can help plug some of that time bar, take some of that off of their plate. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Sure. So I guess the challenge we have is the certified mail. When we send it out through the certified mail, that means that we're still sending it through the U.S. Postal Service, but we have to track to see if the actual document is delivered, and we have to prove that it's delivered. Sometimes it could be a thing that the person doesn't pick it up in the timely manner. We have to wait till it's deemed to be unclaimed, and then that takes a while for the U.S. Postal Service to update that information. And then there's, and that's the only way we can actually prove that the person has still lives there, because people move and they may not notify us in a timely manner that they changed their address and things like that. So that somewhat draws it out too. Mm-hmm.
We were required to submit all of our CEs when we renewed our licenses this year. So doesn't that sort of make all of this moot, because we have all of that information already, because people were required to submit it when they renewed their license? So that saves at least that step.
What if they didn't submit it?
I thought that you couldn't move past that step, but maybe I'm wrong.
Go ahead. I believe that you could go back in afterwards and add it.
Okay.
You could go back in afterwards and add that information in, but you could still proceed if you did not upload the CE.
Okay.
But by going in afterwards, you mean up until the February 28th deadline? Or I could go in, I could get licensed and then go back now, and I could get relicensed and come back here in July or August and put the information in?
Right. So it still would have allowed you to go in afterward and update that information.
But after the February 28th deadline, or
right,
or it had to be by the February 28th deadline.
Right. You still, well, two things. One, we still issued the license whether you uploaded the CEs or not. You just had the option of saying that you were going to do the CEs by the date, but we didn't do a stopgap to say you have to upload the CEs in order to renew. So you had up until the deadline to go in and upload them, but we didn't stop anyone from renewing if they didn't upload the CE.
Is it too late now?
Is the portal still available?
The portal is not, a renewal portal is closed.
Okay.
If the renewal portal closes, that would have been April. So 60 days after, so it would have closed April.
How about we just audit the people? Okay. I don't know.
So as reviewers, will we have access to the portal, or that will still have to be printed down as paper?
Yeah, we'll probably have to print that down as paper.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Could we change the parameters that they must upload by the February 28th deadline for actual license renewal? Because that's when they have to have it done in any case.
Absolutely.
That would give us a leg up, at least, in understanding who is perhaps having issues and who isn't.
Absolutely.
So, Madam Chair, since we are currently updating the regulations relating to your continuing education and renewals, I would recommend we just add in a provision that says that you have to submit it within 30 days. So, at least in the future, if there are people who we don't have theirs already, if they don't do it within 30 days, there's already that one fine, because as Corinne stated, most of the time it's been tracking the person down. And then most of them were only able to be reached by email because they had moved and also in violation of our laws and regulations not updated their address within 30 days. So at least we haven't spent tons and tons of time, staff time, my time. Often we've moved to OAG and they're pending an NOI when we finally hear from them. And then we say, oh, here I have everything. And then it's, you know, no way to recoup that investment of time. So if we add that to the regulations, since we're already in there anyway, it's just a quick addition. If you vote to approve that, we can put that in your regulations, and that's just another arrow in the quiver.
And then does that also make it an order at that point as well?
We can do it in the form of an order, but either way, once it's in the regulations, it's a violation of the reg if you don't do it within 30 days.
Okay.
So we have a motion.
So I believe then, Carla, you're saying we should move that. You recommend modifying the continuing education regulations to indicate that individuals must respond within 30 days from date of receipt of
audit notification.
Of audit notification.
Correct.
Okay. I just moved that.
We have a motion on the floor. Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? I just want to clarify that means, so if we said 30 days of receipt, does that mean that the initial mailing will have to go certified mail?
Mm-hmm. That was
correct,
yeah.
Right. Because there's no other way for us to determine for sure
right. When
the mail was received.
Right.
Right.
So it would still be the heavy lift of the initial certified mail preparation.
We'll figure it out.
Okay.
All right. Any other discussion? Hearing none, we're going to call for the vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 All those opposed? Okay, the motion carries.
Madam Chair. And also, since you asked that question, that will also determine how many people we will audit for the next one.
I'm sorry.
So she asked how much of a burden, I guess, sending out the certified mail, and I would say that will be determined based on how the numbers are for the next audit.
While we're talking about, this is a great segue, Corinne, while we're talking about the next audit, we are behind and we would like to get back on track with the audit to be auditing the current renewal period. So I am proposing to the board to start auditing the detailers, technicians, and pharmacists all at the same time so we could get back on schedule. We didn't do an audit for the detailers because we were still doing this.
I think we're doing it all year. In a different year. They don't renew the same year.
Right, but we never did an audit for the detailers that just passed because we were still doing this audit.
That was the new year, 2018?
Yeah, that was 2018. So I am proposing that we do an audit for the detailer renewal from 2018, the pharmacist and pharmacy technician renewal that we just finished in February.
Okay.
We do it simultaneously, and to ensure we get back on track, we choose 50 individuals from each profession. That's just my proposal. You guys can, you know.
Generally speaking, what I know in the past, for this past renewal, we audited 10% of the licensees. Generally speaking, what do other boards do?
10 is pretty common. 10%.
Okay.
That's going to be a lot.
Yeah, but that brings us at about 300. How many pharmacy technicians and how many details do we have again?
Right. We'll have to look at how many were renewed during that period of time. So the numbers are less than what are reported on today.
Okay. So we have a few options. We can go with our 10%. And I have one more question. If we had to quantify, how many minutes per packet does it take to
review?
Just on average. Well, we all can answer this question.
I guess it just depends on how it's submitted. If they submit the transcript, we can easily identify the requirements. If not, we're going through papers. I will say with the technicians, they may not have a CPE monitor account. They're not required to, so we may get packets of paper. For the detailers, they do not have the CPE monitor. They're not pharmacists or pharmacy technicians, so they would just be sending in paper.
Okay, so it's safe to say maybe 5 to 10 minutes per packet.
Yeah.
Right. So let's just err on the side of that it's about 10 minutes per person when we audit. Okay, so basically trying to determine how much board member time it's going to take for us to review all of these audits. So if we go with 10% of each, thinking that's going to be about 300 people per section, right? Maybe. So that's 900 people in total. If we go with 10%, that's going to be 900 people that we have to review, and that's going to be 9,000 minutes. So 9,000 minutes.
How many detailers and technicians?
Yeah.
Right. So the detailers and the technicians, the detailers, the numbers went down, so we will go on how many people were at that time, because the number of detailers, they drop off because everyone doesn't renew.
Mm-hmm.
The details, so right now it's 839, but I think it's probably less, a lesser number
so
that renew.
10% is what?
Text, it is 879, but I'm not sure how many, you
so
know,
again,
renewed.
To 90 between those two. So maybe we're only reviewing about 600 people.
Still alive.
I mean, So we have to determine whether or not we want to do 10% of each, or if we're going to go with what Sana suggested, which is just 50 from each, just to catch up. What are you all okay with? Well, we can take each section, each group of people separately. Because
right.
I am, you know, just to reiterate that we had about 30% of the pharmacists that we just audited to fail the audit. Well, let's start with the detailers since we're behind on their audit. So, what percentage of detailers do we want to audit?
Well, 10% would only be 80 people. Right?
Maybe.
Yeah, it'll probably be, yeah. It will probably be less than that because it's 10% of how many, 10% of what we have now, but I think 80 is fair.
All right, I move 10% of detailers. We need a motion or just a policy discussion?
I think it's a motion. And then is there a way to get an idea of how many people didn't upload that are
we'll have to, it's a new system, so we will have to work with IT to determine that.
If we have an estimate, then I think that can help the board on maybe what to
do. So if we did 80 detailers, that'll be about 15 hours, so about 3 hours each for all of us. So we can come up for 3 hours and just knock out the detailers. Okay? So we can determine the date for when we want to do that. So we have to make a motion on to do audit of detailers. Yes. Okay. So let's do it all at once. What about for the pharmacy technicians?
So right now we have 879 pharmacy technicians.
With 10%.
One to the same for pharmacists?
So we are also going, everybody who failed the audit is automatically audited again. Is that the case?
That's right.
So that's 90 in addition to whatever we decide right now.
That's right.
Okay. So it's just something to keep in mind.
It's like 5%.
There are 2,045
months. I understand it's a large time commitment, it's a lot of people, but it's what we're supposed to do as far as overseeing.
and making sure that people are doing what they're supposed to do. So even though it's a lengthy time commitment, I don't know if we necessarily can go below 10% of doing like a good, solid review of what they're supposed to have if we're looking out for the public.
Just break up the time.
Anybody
else?
So the other thing it sounded like we wanted to look at was how many individuals, when they renewed, did not upload continuing education credits, right? That would be a natural group that we should be concerned about.
Right. And then also we mentioned for the first time renewal, they didn't upload CE hours either.
Oh, CE. Exactly. Exactly. So it won't be the total.
For all of those professions.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying stay with 10% then?
I think it's a safe number, but maybe we can table the number percentage of pharmacy for sure until we get the sparse out numbers as far as the first years didn't upload and those that just did not upload and they know what to do. But I think 10% is a good, solid number of profession.
Maybe we'll go with 10%. 10% plus the people that failed last year. Or 10%
so it's gonna
to
be more
include
like 15.
We can determine what it to be. So it would be 10% to include those that failed last year.
That sounds fair.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we have a motion.
The last thing that was just said, I have a motion. So it's 10% for pharmacy, for 10% for all the particular subparts, but for pharmacy in particular, those that failed last year are included in that 10%.
Correct.
Did the public, did you guys understand what we just stated?
At least for me, mm-hmm. I can't speak for everyone, but it's almost impossible to hear and understand anything.
Okay.
Because no one's using a mic.
Okay. All right. Make sure you use the microphone. If you can please restate your motion.
My apologies. So for the motion for the auditing for CE audits, for all the subparts for detailers, who else do we have?
Technicians
as well as we would do 10% of the registered subprofessions, 10% of those applications will be audited. For pharmacists, we will also do 10%, but that 10% will be inclusive of those that failed last year's audit.
We have a second?
Okay,
Ashley, second. We have a motion on the floor that was properly moved and second. Do we have any discussion? Okay, hearing none. All those in favor, please go by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, the motion carries. So during the closed session, we will determine the dates and, you know, map out the dates for when we're actually going to come up here so we can trying to get things done so it doesn't move into the next renewal period. Okay. Madam, is there anything else?
Nope. Okay. Did we ever finish off the request for input on topics for the public health?
No.
Were we supposed to do that before we go on to whoever's next or not, is my question.
If you all would like, you have the list. I'm just saying, yeah. We'll have the table. I'll see. I asked someone to provide it to me. Right now, it's not pulling up in my computer. So if it comes up before the end of the open session, we can revisit.
Okay, moving on to the agenda. Is we're going to hear the report from our subcommittees. The first subcommittee report is legislative and regulatory. Dr. Benjamin Miles.
Thank you. So we have been working for quite some time on developing the regulations and the algorithm and questionnaire and referrals for sorry for the Defending Access to Women's Healthcare Services Amendment Act of 2017. We have been meeting as a joint subcommittee with the Board of Medicine and Board of Pharmacy members present. And I believe that the drafted regulations were just passed by the Board of Medicine yesterday. So one of the things that we are going to need to do today is to approve the drafted regulations, which hopefully everybody got a chance to look at prior to this. Also in your packet is the other information that we have developed, including we've got the regulations in section 4B. I'm not going to read through everything, but just to note that the regulations must be approved by both boards, so that's one of our things to do here today. After that, we have developed an algorithm for... So the first thing that we did was develop a questionnaire for patients who present to a pharmacy looking to be prescribed birth control. The questions on the questionnaire correspond to specific parts of the algorithm that we developed after developing the questionnaire. It basically goes through the United States medical eligibility for contraception. This has been looked at by many, many people and torn apart and put back together again many times. But basically, it screens out anybody who may be at risk for being prescribed birth control and requires a pharmacist to refer them to their primary care provider or to an OBGYN. And then if they meet all of those criteria, then the pharmacist is able to prescribe birth control. We also developed two forms for whether the person is prescribed birth control by a pharmacist or if they're not prescribed birth control by a pharmacist, that the pharmacist who prescribes will be required to maintain and also give a copy to the patient, which they can, if it's prescribed, they can take the form to their primary care provider or their women's health provider. If it is not prescribed, there's a separate form that can also be taken to a visit, and it'll say why they were not prescribed birth control. I believe that covers everything. If anybody has any questions for me, I'm happy to answer them.
Just so that we can be all clear, right now we are discussing the draft regulations that allows pharmacists to dispense up to 1 year of birth control after within the guidelines of this legislation and the algorithm and the corresponding questionnaire to go along with this. It's pharmacists prescribing of birth control.
For a motion to approve as presented?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I move the board approve the recommendations as presented.
Okay. We have a motion on the floor. Is there a second?
I'll
second. Okay. So both the motion has been properly moved and seconded. Is there general consensus to
vote favorably for this motion?
If I could just ask, what's next from here so that we're quite aware of sort of what happens next?
So the regulations will move through the regular process of public comment period and all of the other things that go along with that. And once they are published, we will be able to start doing this, prescribing birth control in outpatient pharmacies. there is a requirement that you either possess a doctor of pharmacy or complete a board-approved continuing education. We will have a continuing education program ready to go by the time these regulations are published, and then any other groups that choose to submit something are able to do that as well. But then this will be, we'll be able to do this.
Is there a timeline of how long you think that might be before you could do the step of pharmacy?
What do you, however long it takes to go through the process, which could be.
It depends on if there was, we received public comment from the public. That is the largest variable. If we have to process those public, and then it will have to be referred back to the subcommittee for to see if those suggestions from the public will be incorporated or not. And the board, it also will have to go back to the Board of Medicine. Okay, any other discussion? Okay, all those in favor of the motion, please state by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, the motion carries. We are, the train is leaving.
For pharmacists to be able to prescribe birth control. Okay.
Moving on to the next agenda item, Dr. Miles on collaborative practice regulations.
Oh, so the Board of Medicine, so we were tasked with coming up with a list of standard practice by pharmacists, and we worked with the Board of Medicine to determine what was considered to be standard practice. The reason that we're coming up with this list is because the Board of Medicine has voted to allow the Board of Pharmacy to approve collaborative practice agreements for specific that cover specific areas without needing Board of Medicine approval. So the things that they were okay with include parenteral nutrition, vancomycin dosing, aminoglycoside dosing, phenytoin, anticoagulation, and renal dose adjustments. The things that they would like to continue to discuss and receive more information on include pain management, HIV, diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and depression. And then there was an additional suggestion to add smoking cessation to our list of things that could be approved solely by the Board of Pharmacy. So discussions are ongoing about that. But right now, they have given the Board of Pharmacy approval to approve collaborative practice agreements on those first few things.
So I want to make sure that everyone understands what is being stated right now. So
although it just turns off, we are allowed to engage in collaborative practice agreements in the District of Columbia. The only therapeutic categories in which we would be able to engage in these collaborative practice agreements without an additional approval by the Board of Medicine is listed in the top
section. So that means that as of right now, currently, if a pharmacist wanted to engage in a collaborative practice agreement in any of the therapeutic topics in the bottom, including but not limited to pain management, HIV,
diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and depression, that collaborative practice agreement at this time will require approval from the Board of Medicine.
Can I just ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
So an individual physician requested to have a collaborative collaborative practice agreement with a specific pharmacist could not do in these categories A to F, including smoking cessation. I understand the board, but I mean, an individual couldn't do that?
It would require approval by the Board of Medicine and the Board of Pharmacy in order for that pharmacist to be able to engage in that practice at this point in time. What we're trying to do is make it so that the Board of Medicine is comfortable with a variety of what we consider to be standard of care practice areas for pharmacists and allow the Board of Pharmacy to approve those without approval by the Board of Medicine.
But that's for a broad group of people. But that's why I said an individual highly specialized physician in some situation and a highly specialized pharmacist, I could imagine, not just this is just me because of my issues as well, could have a potentially have an agreement because there's a special drug that they want to make sure that gets used, you know, in a certain way. And without approval from the Board of Pharmacy, they could not do that.
Correct.
So that's pretty much making it prohibitive for the intention of the collaborative practice agreement at this time, especially in these therapeutic categories. So there's more discussion that has to be had to ensure that the members of the Board of Medicine are informed of the role of the pharmacist and what the pharmacist is able to do, because right now they are still not as informed or comfortable with allowing for these collaborative practice agreements, even if it is with two individual people that have already came to the conclusion. This pharmacist said that this physician said they're going to work with this pharmacist. They are still not comfortable with that. So we just still have a lot of work that's left to do in order to ensure that we can participate in these in the collaborative practice agreements the way that we know we can. Yeah.
I wish names or have that discussion been had if a pharmacist or if a pharmacist wanted to submit it to the Board of Medicine, that they would email an individual to their process and then have another discussion about the timeline for the
So at this point in time, we haven't had very many collaborative practice agreements submitted to the board, but basically it would be submitted to the board like anything else, via email, via mail, to Shauna, and she would get it to the rest of us, and then at that point we would share it with the Board of Medicine to get it approved.
Anything else on that? Okay, let's move on to the subcommittee, the communication subcommittee report.
Yes.
I must have missed. Did you accept the Board of Medicine's thing that they say they were okay with it?
Those were our topics to begin with, so we just wanted them to approve it.
Okay, thank you.
So disappointing information.
Yes.
So I believe when they also asked Dr. Miles, when do you have an expected timeline to possibly hear from the Board of Medicine?
Was
that the second part of your question?
Do we have a timeline?
It would be, let's say, something
like that. For the Board of Medicine to actually approve the collaborative practice agreement?
Right.
I would assume that we would try to get it to them for their next scheduled meeting, when they're all together and able to approve something. So we're probably looking at 30 days to 60 days, something like that.
So they meet on the last Wednesday. We meet on the first Thursday of the month, but maybe on the
last Wednesday. Yeah.
The 30 to 60 days is actually, I would say, in a best-case scenario. I think that you should probably plan for at least a 3 to 4 months before you get an answer back from the Board of Medicine.
trying to get clarity, Dr. Miles, because the regulations allow for the collaborative practice agreements to not need approval by either the Board of Medicine or Pharmacy unless it's for protocols outside the standard of care. Mm-hmm. So for this list, I'm just trying to understand how this plays into that regulation.
I sort of had the same question because I think that there are things on this list that we would consider standard of care, but the Board of Medicine doesn't seem to be familiar with what is standard for a pharmacist, and so we've been working to educate or provide that information to them, but it's been an uphill battle.
So then, I guess the position that we would be taking for the public is that the items from the first list, those are all considered as being within the generally accepted standard of care, and those agreements can be entered into for these conditions. The second part is considered at this point outside the generally accepted standard of care, and then those collaborative practice agreements would need to be submitted for review and approval on a case-by-case basis.
That's what it appears, although I wonder if that's necessary, if these things are considered to be standard of care.
There's a disconnect between what the Board of Medicine feels is standard of care and what the Board of Pharmacy feels is standard of care in terms of what responsibilities can be delegated to the pharmacist. So as of this time, I mean, we are still in discussion. There was a subcommittee that was formed with the Board of Pharmacy, with representatives from both the Board of Pharmacy and the Board of Medicine to try to get to a consensus as to what is standard of care. And so at this time, as the agenda states, that there still needs to be continued discussion and research for the below topic, even though it is for the pharmacy profession, the topics on the bottom is considered standard of care.
So, for my pharmacy students in the room, if you're on a rotation and you have a preceptor and you're in a diabetes clinic, okay? If there's a patient that's seen by the pharmacist and the pharmacy students, and then the preceptor signs like the encounter form or the progress note, and then the physician countersigns, is that okay? So if they're not under a collaborative practice agreement, but if they're in a clinic working together and the pharmacist signs and the physician countersigns behind that pharmacist, are they operating within the proper scope of practice or subject to disciplinary action at this point?
As long as the physician countersigns, they are operating within the scope of practice.
No, because the pharmacist isn't doing it independently.
Oh, right. That's right. Okay. So, again, Dr. Miles, I just want to understand. At the beginning, I thought you said the Board of Medicine had agreed to let the Board of Pharmacy do something without the Board of Medicine. What was that?
That was the top list that we were, although those are now considered standard of
care.
That's
my point. There's nothing for us to approve.
Right.
So.
Right. Well, I don't know.
But do the boards have to agree on what standard of care for them to move forward with?
But I thought we defined that in the regulations, in the definition section. I can't pull them up.
Are you looking for approval of protocols outside of standard of care?
Mm-hmm. And then I thought we defined standard of care in the definition.
If we didn't define it, it just says generally accepted clinical standard of care.
You check 99 definitions. Because that was... And keep in mind, we worked on these for so many years, the composition of the boards changed. So early on, the Board of Medicine did not want to have to review these. And so that's why it was drafted, so that generally accepted standard of care would not need to be reviewed. And only those things that were outside. They're in.
So the way that standard of care is defined in the regs is the course of action that other prudent and well-trained health professionals in the same field of practice will customarily take under the same or similar circumstances.
So we defined it so that we could agree on what it is. So I guess maybe in those discussions, we just kind of need to help the new crop of board members over there kind of know we addressed all of that in the regs, and it really should be set up that we're identifying the outliers as opposed to these are the things that are okay. We really should be saying these are the things that are not okay.
Okay.
And that would be the only ones that in both boards would need to approve.
Okay.
But just be rest assured that the Board of Pharmacy is in constant communication with the Board of Medicine and providing education as to what a pharmacist is, has been doing and is capable of doing in terms of management of patients. There is just a learning curve that is still, we're still dealing with. Okay, so we're going to move on to the next agenda item, the Communication Subcommittee Report.
So previously, Dr. Bernard was head of the Communication Subcommittee and worked on the newsletter with me to complete and send to the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy. So we would need some new volunteers for the Communication Subcommittee to work on the newsletter or any communications that the Board of Pharmacy would like to have.
So right now, the Board of Pharmacy, we have two subcommittees. We have the Legislative and Regulatory Subcommittee, and then we also have the Communications Subcommittee. So do we want to determine, right now we should determine what board members are serving on what subcommittee. We are currently have on the Legislative and Regulatory Subcommittee, we have Dr. Miles, James Appleby, and Alan Friedman that's currently serving on those subcommittees and have been serving on those subcommittees. So we can determine now whether or not we want to reform all the subcommittees, or do we want the remaining board members to stay on the subcommittee? It's totally up to the board how you want to structure this. But we need to have every board member participating on the subcommittee.
I'm the only one not on the subcommittee.
So.
No, you're not.
You
can step back.
So I can do it later. Okay, so Chiquita and Ashley. We're gonna, you're gonna be on a subcommittee for communications.
Right.
Okay. All right. Moving on to the current topics in pharmacy that is listed in your agenda underneath the NABPE newsletter. So there were a few articles that we wanted to bring to your attention for discussion. The first is about reducing just the presence of counterfeit drugs that are out there and that people are accessing and how harmful it has been, both in reference to the opioid epidemic and also to our children. So when you think of, there was an article written by a former DEA agent about the presence of counterfeit opioids that is available online. And that's mostly the place, whenever we speak about counterfeit medications, it is usually something that was purchased online or in the black market. And so I just want to reiterate to us that we need to inform our consumers that if they are purchasing medications online, that it is likely that that medication may be counterfeit. And if they want to ensure the integrity of medications that are purchased online, that they ensure that they get the medication from a .pharmacy website. Moving on, PTCB has offered to streamline the recertification process for certified pharmacy technicians via the NABPE profile. Are there many of you here that utilizes the NABPE profile to manage your own continuing education requirements, pharmacists? Okay, so those pharmacists that utilize that e-profile that is now available for a certified pharmacy technician to manage their profile as well through CPE monitoring. The FDA issued a warning to companies selling illegal kratom products via social media and other websites. Does anybody know what kratom is? So when I was reading this headline, it assured me how important it is for a pharmacist to not only know what is available through traditional or legend or OTC drugs, but also to maintain our knowledge in herbal products or what we call, herbals and alternative medication. So this product, kratom, is actually a tropical tree that is native to Southeast Asia and provides opiate-like effects. And so what two companies were doing was selling the product, were marketing the product saying that it can help with opioid withdrawal symptoms. And so the FDA issued a warning for them to stop doing that. But we have to be aware as to what our patients and our consumers are taking in the market. We have to stay abreast as to what is available out there. So there's a lot of false claims, and we just have to stay abreast as to what's out there. Next, we have four Mississippi healthcare providers, two pharmacists and two nurses that was actually indicted for participating in a compounding fraud scheme in which they stole over $7 million from the TRICARE military program. So they were indicted by pretty much providing compounded products that were not medically necessary. And so I just want to reiterate, especially to the students or new practitioners out there, that it is not worth your license or your practice to try to make some extra money by being deceitful to the insurance companies. It is definitely going to end up catching up to you sooner rather than later. And the DEA hosted a industry association conference to collaborate on prevention prescription drug abuse. This conference was held in Washington, D.C., and attendees included industry leaders from the manufacturing companies, distributions, wholesalers, and practitioners. Again, usually when these conferences occur, there's always a focus on access to products. But I do believe that the conversation that we're missing the most about as it relates to prescription drug abuse is the mental portion, or just why people become addicted to substances in the first place. Because as we already seen, even though the access to opioid drugs has decreased, what has happened is now there's a black market for the counterfeit opioid. As much as we try to, and we have been able to control the amount of opioid drugs that are on in the market or just in out there, but we're still not doing an effective job of just addressing addiction in and of itself and why people are abusing substances in and of itself. And until we really put some energy into that portion, I don't think that we will really truly be able to see any real movement as it relates to this prescription drug abuse. Just an update that there have been changes to the USP General Chapters that will become official in December 1st, 2019. So those of you that are practicing, again, compounding, or especially hospital practitioners, just to be aware of those changes. And another mention of the counterfeit medications that caused, there's a study that estimated that counterfeit medication caused over 300,000 child fatalities annually. So when we talk about, again, counterfeit medications, it's access to prescription medications. And how is that access being, why aren't people being able to have access? So in addition to, as pharmacists and as practitioners, understanding how just to dispense medication, but we also need to be in the realm of just healthcare service to ensure that people have everything they need so that they can access healthcare properly. So that can also mean us stepping outside of our realm and making sure that people have the proper insurance so that they can have access to medication, so that they don't have to go again to like the black market or online to try to get treatment for their children. We should be aware, especially in the District of Columbia, as many of you may or may not know, that the District of Columbia has the lowest uninsured rate in the country. That's because we have several programs, and the threshold, the income threshold for people to be able to participate in the local DC Medicaid and other, we also have Alliance for those that's not eligible for Medicaid, that there is insurance available for our residents. So take some time to educate yourself about what is available to our residents so that we can ensure that they are not going, utilizing other routes to try to get their medication that may, again, cause deaths. Along the same realm, when we have the U.S. Marshals seize adulterated dietary supplements from Life Rising Corporation due to poor manufacturing practices. So we have to just know, we should feel good that we live in a country that we have, where that makes sure that what is out there is pure and not can cause harm to those of us that ingest it. And last but not least, leading expert in counterfeit medications rejoins the PSM Board of Directors. So the counterfeit medications, again, is a hot topic right now, something that we need to educate ourselves on and make sure that we educate the public to avoid these counterfeit medications. And it's, again, very much so linked to access of care. So our vulnerable populations are more, they are more at risk for encountering counterfeit medication. Okay, so we have two matter for consideration for the board. Dr. Lahr from Howard University, and I'm going to have to recuse myself from this matter. Dr. Miles, come and take my seat.
I think that the issue that is before us right now is that a professor at Howard University has requested an exemption from licensure requirements for international students who are visiting the United States and who are shadowing pharmacists in their various places of business, I guess, and we would like to hear from you, I guess.
Thanks for inviting me to come talk to you guys. So I run the international programs at the College of Pharmacy, and I read the meeting minutes from last meeting 2 months ago, so sorry I wasn't able to be there to provide further clarification, but I don't know if it would help for me to address the discussion from last time or if you want a little bit of background on where this is coming from.
I guess just for everybody's information, we'll take a little bit of background.
Okay. So we've been doing this for a number of years now, and we've never really had an issue with it because we don't actually classify incoming international visitors as interns, and we have never classified them as that. We call them formally international visiting scholars because sometimes they're students and sometimes they're licensed pharmacists from overseas that are just curious about learning more about what we do in the U.S. And we have multiple partners where we exchange students. So we send almost now up to 40 students of college pharmacy students at Howard overseas to various different sites. And to reciprocate, we allow those partner sites to send people to us because there's not really any payment involved between these exchanges. So they come for shadowing purposes, and we really title it shadowing because we don't actually keep them in any given place for, you know, extensive periods of time. So our rotations traditionally are 5 weeks long. We move them every couple of weeks to show them different practice settings that our pharmacists can work in. The issue that came up actually in January was we had an international student from Jamaica shadowing at Howard University, and I believe at that time the university was going, or the hospital was going under a visit by JACO, and our international student didn't have an intern license and then got kicked out of rotation. They wouldn't let her back in. And we were trying to let them know she's not an intern, she's only going to be here for a couple weeks. But when that happened, now they're saying that no international visitor can come to Howard University, even though we keep telling them this is not a matter of an intern or not, like, we don't call them interns. And so the matter is still kind of in place right now in terms of the director of pharmacy is not really, she has issues with them coming on board. And so with that, we were trying to figure out what is the solution here. We actually did try to look up what the process would be to get international visitors with an intern license, and the process is so difficult because they need fingerprints and they don't live here, and to even get into the U.S. Embassy to get these fingerprints is a whole mess for them. And so we tried and it wasn't working, and so what we were trying to do is to talk with you guys to get, and I guess maybe to clarify the discussion from last time. It's not that we classify them as interns, we don't, but I think some hospitals, and this is not all hospitals, think that they're interns. And so when they ask us for something, we say they're not. But the only way that I guess we can really prove it is if we say, oh, the Board of Pharmacy also does not see them as interns, so please let them in. If that helps clarify.
Okay, so I will also say that I have had international students on rotation with me, and I agree with you that they're not performing any of the functions that an intern would perform under our regulations. I think one of the concerns that some of the other members of the board had was that it sounded like rotations, that they were transitioning from place to place, and they were wondering if they received any academic credit for being here. Do you know if that's the case?
So in terms of academic credit, schools overseas consider different things to be, I guess, appropriate for them in their school and whatever curriculum they hold. Us as Howard, we do not, as Howard, provide them with any credit. So we don't say, under the College of Pharmacy, we now give them 3 credit hours. Now, if they go back, if we give them like a certificate of completion at the end of the couple of weeks that they're here, they take that home. Now, if the school back in whatever country they came from says, okay, this is good enough for us, we have no control over that. But the College of Pharmacy does not give them any credit.
Do any of the other board members have any opinions about this? I mean, personally, I feel like if somebody's coming from another country and they're not familiar with the names of the drugs that we have, I've found it very difficult to teach about specific pharmacotherapy or whatever, like I would with a regular student from a United States College of Pharmacy, and the whole experience is completely different from an actual rotation that a student here would take. So I'm kind of in favor of not. Yes.
I have a question. I think for me as a lay person, what I thought was a little confusing is the wording in the request that these students would not be participating in the above activities for more than 70% of the time. The above activities being things like compounding drugs, evaluating prescriptions, and so on and so forth.
Sure.
So it, to me, seemed as if you were saying they will be doing some of this, but just not for more than 70% of the time. If what you are saying is they will not be doing that at all, then that, I think, makes a difference. And if
that's what comes to us in writing, that they will not do any of this at all, then I think that makes it a little clearer. But this seemed to suggest they would do it sometime, but just not more than 70% of the time.
So with our international visitors, we generally, usually preceptors that take them, they might be in those settings. So let's say they want to see what community pharmacy does. We might put them in that setting for a week or two to see it. But generally, our preceptors, because they're not licensed pharmacists or interns, it's a shadowing opportunity. So they don't take a tech position and start counting things or filling things. They see what happens. They learn about what happens. They have discussions with the preceptor on why this is happening and these are the policies that are in the U.S. and this is how pharmacists function. And so when we say they're not doing them, it's not that they're not doing them, but they might be seeing them, if that makes sense. They might be observing them.
That's been my experience, too, that they act as a shadow. We go, we talk to a patient, something happens, we talk about it afterwards, but they're not actually, you know, putting together epinephrine syringes in a coat.
We do require, from the Howard University side, require HIPAA training because they do have eyes on patient information. We do require infection control training because they sometimes step inside a hospital. They do go through a background check at the university simply because we have to give them some kind of temporary ID. And so they do go through all of the paperwork from the university side, and they formally assign a temporary ID and everything. So we do that to make sure that they're going through a process.
So if we are clear that they're not actually performing any of these functions, are we safe to say that they do not require licensure? So what do you guys think?
Right, as long as I was kind of like you, like, are they doing it 50% of the time? And if she's saying they're not doing it at all, I don't see a problem. I was attempting to clarify. Right.
Okay. So basically what we're looking for is clarification that they are strictly shadowing and that they're not performing any of the functions of a pharmacy intern or a pharmacy technician in order to allow for an exemption.
Okay. So should we just redraft the letter and send it to you guys?
Yes.
Okay. And then is it possible, I mean, because the dean drafted this letter when I was working with her on this, and I'll have her fix it up. I guess the question is, it would be helpful if we could just have like a formal signed letter from you guys so that so that we can show Howard University, hey, this should be okay according to the Board of Pharmacy as well as us. So can I put that verbiage in there for somebody to sign so that we have some kind of proof? Because I guess right now it's just kind of our word saying, hey, the Board of Pharmacy is okay with this.
Sorry, so once you submit your letter, we will respond in writing to that letter.
Okay.
To start with a formal presentation from Anthea Francis, the Office of Continuing Professional Education at Howard University College of Pharmacy.
So thank you very much. I would like to thank Dr. White and Ms. Barron for allowing me to present and speaking, and Madam Chair, as well as other members of the board. Thank you. And as well. So as it was mentioned, I am the coordinator of the Howard University College of Pharmacy and Office of Continuing Professional Education. And the reason for my coming here
working.
So the reason for my coming here is that our office was awarded a grant by REMS, RPC company, to educate in response to the FDA mandate. And this FDA mandate actually came about because around 2011, the opioid, because of the opioid crisis, the FDA mandated that manufacturers, drug companies, set aside money for independent continuing education with respect to educating healthcare professionals on the dangers of prescription opioid abuse and addiction. The interesting thing, thank you so much, I appreciate it.
Just let me know what you want me to advance.
Okay, no problem, thank you. The interesting thing was that of the 10 named health professionals, pharmacists were listed as number 7. And yet, in the 7-year, at that time, the 7-year grant cycle of this grant being awarded, no pharmacy institution had been awarded the grant. So we're looking at the opioid crisis, this FDA mandate to educate healthcare professionals about the dangers of opioid abuse. Pharmacists listed as number 10 out of the 7 out of the 10 healthcare professionals, and yet no pharmacy institution had been awarded. I can't stress that enough because that's a huge deal. So we applied for the grant. By the grace of God, we were granted it. And the reason I'm here is to invite all of you, hopefully, to be able to come and attend. It's not just open. It's actually a grant that's directed to pharmacy professionals in terms of CE, but the information that is available is open to everyone. And the exciting thing about it, and there's the Save the Date flyer. I've also passed out, some of you have it, so you can take it with you. A Save the Date flyer. It's going to be on Friday, September 6th, and you can advance to the next slide. It's going to be on Friday, September 6th in Crampton Auditorium, which is on the campus of Howard University. This is a sample program that we have. We're going to have the privilege of having the Deputy Surgeon General, Dr. Erica Schwartz, who will serve as our keynote speaker. We'll also have he's retired now, Dr. Norman Kahn. He's a retired family practice physician who will also be speaking. And interestingly enough, he was one of the primary authors of the FDA blueprint. And I'm going to address that. You can advance to the next slide. In terms of the FDA mandate, this symposium is important for the reasons I've listed here, and some of them. The fact that it's going to focus on needs, it's going to give a laser-like focus on what we need as pharmacy professionals. And the fact that we're incorporating pharmacy technicians in this training as well is exciting. We're also going to have hands-on naloxone administration certification training. And guess where one of the sites for the training will be? Will include our flagship simulation center at Howard University. For those of you who may not know, Howard Simulation Center and Clinical Skills Laboratory is a flagship center, not just on the East Coast, quite frankly, in the nation. And when President Obama was in office, he actually held a climate change conference or convention there or training there. So, aside from the fact that we're going to provide this hands-on training by our FDA colleagues, professionals who will be our trainers, we're also shining a light on the national opioid crisis, but also on its impact in the District of Columbia, where we have come in terms of the National Safety Council, how we have progressed, how we measure up against other states and U.S. territories and the like. You can advance to the next slide, please. The FDA blueprint and mandate, which is why this grant is even being awarded, period, really looks at different issues, and it mandates to work in improving the safe use of opioids by addressing opioid abuse while assuring appropriate access to effective pain treatment. And this really ties into what our board, you know, the board members were discussing today in terms of the opioid crisis and the like. The FDA has required manufacturers of opioid analgesics, as I mentioned, known as the REMS program companies, to make education available for healthcare practitioners, HCPs. And as I mentioned, one of the professions listed in the blueprint were pharmacists. And so this is exciting, and we would like to welcome your support and attending. And you can advance to the next slide, the last slide. Just a little bit about our office. We've been serving as a CE provider for over two decades. We are accredited by, of course, the governing body for pharmacy, Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education. We are, and please listen carefully, we're the only College of Pharmacy in the District of Columbia. I don't think it should be lost on us, too, that we're an HBCU, and that has significant relevance. Over last year, during a very brief period of time, we've bumped up the number of CE programs that we have been accrediting, serving over 1,200 participants, offering over 1,300 hours of continuing professional education. And that we have to thank the leadership of Dean Tafade, Dr. Daftery, chair of the department under which this office falls, because now they have someone that's dedicated as a CE coordinator, as opposed to in the past, you know, Dr. Bernard can speak to it, and others who had to do this on top of their other sundry responsibilities. So I once again want to thank Dr. White and Ms. Barnes and the rest of the board for allowing us to speak. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer. But hopefully you'll be able to join us on Friday, September 6th, Crampton Auditorium, for a full day of education surrounding opioids.
Thank you very much, Ms. Francis. Hoping that those of you in the audience spread the word and take advantage of this wonderful opportunity for pharmacists to really truly be educated about opioid management and pain management. Do we have anybody else that would like to make any announcements? And I'm not sure if, I think I see a few people that came in after we had introductions. So if you were not able to introduce yourself and your affiliation, can you please do so at this time? Any more announcements? Okay, if I can get a motion to adjourn the open session for today.
I'll do it.
Okay,
do it. I'm not going to use the microphone for this. It's a lot. Madam Chair, I move that the board close the open public session portion of the meeting and move into the closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC Official Code 2-575B for the following purposes: to discuss disciplinary matters pursuant to 2-575B9, to seek advice of counsel to the board, to preserve the attorney-client privilege, or to approve settlement agreements pursuant to 2-575B4, and to plan, discuss, or hear reports concerning ongoing or planned investigations pursuant to 2-575B14.
Okay.
Thank you.
Here.
All right.
All right, so we're now going to institute a roll call vote. As I call your name, board member, you can vote yay or nay to adjourn the meeting. Ashley Bow.
Yay.
Benjamin Miles.
Yay.
Chiquita Saunders.
Yay.
And for the record, I want to acknowledge that James Appleby is currently not in the room. Okay, so hearing all of the yay votes, this meeting is now adjourned. This concludes the public open session of the meeting. The board will now move into the closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC Official Code 2575B for the reasons set forth in the motion. The open session meeting is now adjourned at 11:41 a.m. Thank you very much.
Okay, sure. Thank you.
You guys want to take a 20-minute break?